Back to the book bag today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Rebecca Wee.
And I'm Don Wooten. There are too many books to read these days, but we'll talk about some of them on Scribble. Sundoku. Wonderful Japanese term that means too many books that you haven't read, and my house is full of them.
Oh, tell me about it. I have to kind of make a path through my bedroom with the piles. You know, this pile is more immediate. This one is for later. But I look at them and think, you have to have time to process when you're reading, and there just isn't very much of
that. I know. It's miserable. And my affliction is that I, in order to keep up with the world, I subscribe to about 36 magazines.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always a pile of those things
yep.
in the mailbox. Some are weekly, some are monthly, some are quarterly,
yep.
and they come in, and I think, okay, let's look through this and see what I need to know or want to know or looks interesting.
Yep.
And by the time you finish that and you look at the books over there and you think,
I know.
So what am I going to do?
Where do you start? How do you finish? Yeah.
But I'll tell you what I'm interested in right now. And let me hog the first time here. Back in the 90s, I read a book that had come out in Italy in 1988 and was translated in this country in 1993 by, I think, a guy named Tim Park. The author was Roberto Colasso, and he wrote a book called The Marriage of Cadmus and Harmony. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting title. And I decided to read it. I'd heard that people were praising it, so, well, let's see what's going on. And it starts off with the legend of with Zeus and Europa. And it takes about a page and a half to tell the story. A break, and then he tells the story again from another point of view, another version.
Uh-huh.
I finish that, and there's another version. Of the same story.
The same story.
It's the darndest thing. It's the most strangely constructed book of all. But he does that. He just takes it story by story and gives you the variants. And you wind up with the wedding of Cadmus and Harmony. Harmonia is her real name. And this was the last time the gods and humans sat down at table together. But the idea about mythology is that these are just stories that people told.
Yeah.
And the stories morphed over time. And it is fascinating to go through that and see how we don't tell the same story the same way.
Right.
And that's true of the basic stuff. He really goes from the Metamorphoses all the way back to Homer to cover all these stories that people told.
So did he write each version, or was he taking different versions that other people had
written? He took different versions and he explained them in his own language.
He didn't invent all the speaking voices.
Oh, no.
Okay.
But that is a great book. But now I have just ordered a trilogy by an actor that people have seen in the movies and on television. He played the role of Jeeves, I think, in a great TV production of that Wodehouse series.
Okay.
And it's called Mythos. And that's what he does. He tells the mythological, he takes those subjects and he tells them in his own way. The first one is Mythos. The second is Heroes, about Greek heroes. And the one that is just coming out is Troy, I've not read any of them, but I am going to.
So you're waiting for them to arrive.
Oh, yeah. And I don't know how I'm going to get through because there's so many things to read. But he also did a three-act play called Mythos, which I think was staged in Canada. And it was going to have a big opening in Britain. I don't know if they actually got it done because the Canadian production, I think, was in 2019. That's before the pandemic just messed up everything.
Yeah.
But Stephen Fry has always interested me as an actor. And I'm charmed to think that he is also a writer.
Yeah.
And the early reviews on those look really good. So
excellent.
Yeah.
So we're going to use today to kind of give people things for their reading lists that are too big, things
well,
that we think they should, that we're interested in, so they might want to consider adding to their own piles.
How long does it take you to read a book?
Oh, it depends. It's, for me, since I'm so often reading poems, collections of poems, and you would think that would be quick because poems tend not to be that long, but it takes, I depending on how they resonate with me, it might be that I can only read one poem in a day because then I'm so overcome by it, or I'm thinking about it all day, or I want to write my own poem that answers it, you know, that I sometimes sit with a skinny little volume of poems and think it's going to take me all year to get through these because I can't handle more than one or two at a time. Prose and fiction I can do more quickly, but it takes me... When I was a kid and I didn't get interrupted and I could read, you know, with my flashlight at night under my blankets, I could get through books in a matter of a day or two. You know, it just, I just swallowed them whole.
Well, there's so many books that are written today that serve that purpose.
Yeah.
You know, you're just supposed to zip through them.
Yeah.
And you finish them in an evening, or if it's worth a close reading, maybe two evenings.
Yeah, I guess I don't read very many of
well,
those.
I read a lot of junk.
well, I shouldn't. I don't mean to sound like I'm too pure for that. I learned the joys or the, I don't know, the diversion of People magazine when I was sitting in the hospital a lot with...
Yeah, and they don't give you better magazines.
Well, they do, but I at that time I really didn't want to think very much. You know, it was when my husband was undergoing treatment for leukemia, and it was long days and frightening days, and you know, really high emotion, and I couldn't handle. You know, I had this idea that I'll read my poems because they'll sort of feed me, and I didn't have any room to feel. Yeah. Anything else. And so I discovered, you know, the purpose of those kind of magazines in waste, you know, in the waiting rooms of hospitals.
Well, I was addicted for a long time to murder mysteries.
Oh, yeah.
Peter Robinson's great series on that Yorkshire detective. And then the, what's his name? Montaglione. The Sicilian Detective. I love those books.
Yep.
And you just rip through them, and I can't tell you what was in any of them.
Right.
Because
you know,
they serve the moment.
Yep. That I think that the kind of reading probably you and I both love best is the kind that requires a kind of contemplative savoring of it, you know, that you don't just whip through them. Or if you read them quickly, then you need time to process afterwards.
Oh, yeah. When I read Lord of the Rings, I couldn't get through it fast enough.
Exactly.
And then I immediately read it again slowly.
Yeah. I had the same experience. And it was, you could read it fast and it was thrilling and it kept pace, but there was so much going on that you had to go back.
In the beginning, I thought, this Tom Bombadil character is stupid. What is he doing here? Why is he wasting my time? But on a rereading, I thought, oh, I see Tom Bombadil in a different light.
Yeah. Yeah.
The poetry in there was terrible, but the story was just great.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a completely created world. If you've never read Lord of the Rings, you can't get out of this world without reading
it. Without doing it, I know.
I can't think of anything that is more fulfilling, more absorbing. It's just amazing.
Did you go to the movies or see the movies when they came out? Because I didn't do that. I didn't want anybody else's idea of what those characters looked like. I wanted to keep my own, so I never saw the movies.
I have a friend who refused to go to see the movies, and I said, "You're making a mistake. They're really pretty good."
Yeah.
But then I found out that those are the commercial releases, but you could get Peter Jackson's edit of those mm-hmm. three movies, so I bought that.
Okay.
And it's amazing. The movies were longer, but they went faster. Huh. The story just seemed to move so quickly in the longer edition.
Oh, that's interesting.
And same thing about Dances with Wolves.
Mm.
When I saw the editor's edit on that, I thought, oh, all of a sudden a scene that didn't make sense,
that worked.
Yeah, that makes sense now because the full context is there. And that seemed to go faster. I can't explain that.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I have just resisted it, I guess, because I loved with Tolkien. I loved the richness of everything I saw when I read those words, and I didn't want it replaced by anybody else's version that this character looks like this or sounds like this. But I know people like you whose judgment I trust, who love the movies.
Careful,
so.
Careful.
I'll get to it someday.
But there is a when they had the big meeting at which they formed the Fellowship of the Ring, mm-hmm. that went rather quickly, and it was long in the book.
Yeah.
And then later on, I understood why, because at that point, Tolkien realized he'd gotten himself into a mess and there were things he had to explain.
Sure.
So he had to have a lot of backstory occur at that meeting.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's interesting how an author covers up something like that and still makes it interesting.
Yeah, that you get yourself in over your head and have to answer for it.
Starting out that book, you know, come on, 3 feet high, furry feet.
Yeah, I know.
I thought, what am I doing reading this nonsense? But once you get to the inn at Bree, you can't read fast enough.
Right, yep.
But anyway, have you encountered any book of poetry that you are fascinated with right now?
I'm actually, probably the one I'm thinking of, it's not new, but this comes out of the fact that my mother a couple weeks ago suddenly learned that she had to have triple bypass surgery. We didn't know this. The whole family kind of went to the hospital and spent about a week. This was in Fargo, North Dakota, at Sanford. It was a Sanford hospital, and it was extraordinary place and experience because, you know, here you are terrified that, you know, your parents may not survive. I had my kids with me. My brother and sister flew from California. And it reminded me of all that time that I spent reading People magazine when my husband was mm-hmm. sick years ago. Because there is such just a particular world of the hospital vigil, you know, when you're waiting for news that, you know, can be so joyful or so traumatic. And it reminded me how after Michael died and after I came back to Augustana, I was contacted by a woman named Karen Miller, who was at the time lived in Minneapolis, because she was putting together a book called The Cancer Poetry Project. I think it was because I had published one of my poems about sitting in the waiting room. And she had seen it, but I can't even remember now why she got a hold of me. But it turns out that the book that I've just gone to revisit because of my mother being in the hospital, Miller put together years ago because her husband had gotten sick and was in the hospital and started writing poetry. And he'd been, I think, part of the business world or, you know, not inclined toward poetry at all. And she was so fascinated by why being in the hospital was causing him not to want to read it, but to write it. And then in the years, I think it was a year or more, she came to realize in talking with the nurses, the doctors, they become kind of your friends and your companions, how many of them had written poems, even though they didn't consider themselves poets. So she gathered in this book called The Cancer Poetry Project, it was a collection, if I'm remembering, she had it organized as these were the poems written by the patients themselves. These were the poems written by the doctors and the staff. These were the poems written by the family members and the friends and the people that came and sat at the bedside, some of whom considered themselves poets in their other life, but not most of them. And so I dug that out when I got home. My mother's doing very well. We had, at least for that chapter, a really good outcome. And I was struck again by just the extraordinary lives lived by people who work in a hospital setting, whether they are the ones coming in and checking all your numbers, whether it's the doctor that's holding the heart in their hands. And the need to try to articulate that by the people who go through it or see it.
How do you get a hold of this book?
It is published, let's see, it was printed, I think you can just go on Amazon and they've got there are two different versions of it. The first one that Karen did, and I actually have two poems in there, I think, and one of them I've never looked back at. It was titled Widow. And I hated that word, and I was trying to write a poem in response to that word that was going to be my new identity, you know. And I have it in my office on my bookshelf, but I've looked through it. I've looked at other people's poems, and I can't bring myself to look at that one again.
Yeah. What's the title of that book?
The book that it's in is The Cancer Poetry Project. That one, the editor is Karen Miller. Miller is the one. And then there was a second one. She did a second one, I think, in maybe 2013, which was just another compilation of them. But one of the things that intrigued me about it was how poetry became this language for people who maybe didn't normally care about it or speak it or read it, when they were in these conditions of this kind of fear and extremity, that there was something.
So The Cancer Poetry Project by Karen Miller. You can look up Miller and that book.
Yeah.
Let me go into politics a little bit here. There is a very important book out now by Adam Gentleson, Gentleson, called Kill Switch. Now, there's an argument going on right now about the filibuster, and people treat it as if it were some kind of sacred thing. I believe Mitch Miller talked about a foundational thing. It isn't at all. It isn't what the... As a matter of fact, there's no Senate I can think of that has something like the filibuster except the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
And that came about because the Senate in the beginning had five different rules for limiting debate. They didn't want people to run on and on. The job of the Senate is to cast a vote. But after several years, they were revising their rules and they thought, well, you know, we're gentlemen. We'll know when we've spoken enough. So they took those rules out. And then a Southern senator, in order to prevent the addition of non-slave states, decided to keep talking and get his friends to keep talking until the session ended. And that became formalized into something called the filibuster. And I think it was in 1917 they finally wrote some rules about it.
Okay.
But they shouldn't have written any rules at all. What you do in any legislative body is after you've argued and argued, someone calls the question. Mm-hmm. Then you take a vote. Are we going to vote on this now or do we keep talking?
Yeah.
You take a vote, majority decides, and then you go on. But you should never, according to the Founding Fathers, leave a question undecided.
Uh-huh.
And so that was something, a byproduct of the slave states, that is not foundational. It is an obstruction, and it has made the Senate almost useless. It is the only deliberative body where the minority can rule rather than the majority, which is an anomaly that's only true here in the United States.
Yeah.
So it's very carefully researched and in great detail. You ought to take a look at it. It's called Kill Switch by Adam Gentleson. He also points out that the Senate found other ways to avoid doing work by loading up committees and deciding on a committee process that further slowed things down.
Sure.
And the filibuster stops it, so the Senate doesn't have to do anything.
Isn't that? And I'm thinking about committees I've been on. how that is a wide-reaching practice, I'm afraid.
Committees, if we haven't got anything to do, let's have a meeting. But that's called Kill Switch, and it's really worth your time reading.
So that one you have read. That's not one that's on your to-read list.
Yeah, that's Kill Switch is one. As a matter of fact, I've already lent it out once.
Yeah.
And in return, I was given a book to read called The Man Who Ran Washington. It was about Baker, who was chief of staff for Reagan. Later on, he secretary of the Treasury. Then for the first Bush, he was Secretary of State. He was active in Ford's presidency. And then with George W. Bush, he not only ran his campaigns, but he also was the one who went down and managed that vote count in Florida that got him in office. And that is in contrast with a book that came out about Richard Holbrooke. Richard Holbrooke is a fascinating guy, loaded with talent, but his own worst enemy. And he just kept getting in the way of his own successes. There was a book about him by George Packer, I think, about a year or so ago. And then with this book, we're getting books not about presidents. We've had way too many books about Nixon, about Bush, about Trump. But these are two guys who were in the mix. They made things happen. And those are the people, we talk about the bureaucracy and all the secret state, that's malarkey. But the fact is, you depend on people like that for government to run.
Yeah.
And you might want to read this, The Man Who Ran Washington. It's by two veteran writers and reporters, Peter Baker. You may have seen him on TV, but he writes for the New York Times, and Susan Glasser, who writes for the New Yorker. And it is a wonderful, wonderful book in prospect. I'm just getting into it.
Okay.
And it's a hefty one, but I think you'll find it interesting. So Kill Switch and The Man Who Ran Washington.
So I'm going to ask you your own question that you asked me. How long does it take you to get through these?
I'm not through it yet.
But what about the Kill Switch?
Kill Switch didn't take long, about off and on over 3 days, I suppose, because I get distracted.
I know. That's that.
Yeah. But those are two books that I think you would be very useful. Have anything else on your agenda?
I'll give you two titles just because, and I've only begun both of them, so I don't have my final decision about them, but so far I'm really interested. One is called 12 Tiny Things, Simple Ways to Live a More Intentional Life. Doesn't that sound like a title that you've heard dozens of times?
Oh, yeah.
Not another one of
these.
Not
another 12-step deal.
But this has really intrigued me. So I may eat my words once I finish it. Maybe I'll have to come back. But it's by two women, Heidi Barr and Ellie Rocher. And they've got these 12 kind of areas of attention. I'll just give you a couple of them here. So space, work, spirituality, food, style, nature, communication. All those sound really familiar too, right? It's like, there's nothing new to say about any of this. Home, sensuality, creativity, learning, and community. But they have done something really extraordinary, and I haven't figured it out yet quite. But how to even give you an example? The first one, which is titled Space, just starts with like a dictionary definition of space. You know, it's a noun. It's a continuous area or expanse that is free, available, unoccupied. And then these two writers both kind of come in with their versions about it. And this whole project was inspired by the pandemic, really, by kind of despairing in their lives, in their work. Okay, a lot has been written on that too already, you know, even though it's still a sort of new phenomenon.
Well, 12 tiny things.
12 tiny things. Heidi Barr, B-A-R-R, and Ellie Roscher.
I'll give you 2 minutes to give us the second
title. Oh, the second title. Just, this one's wonderful. Who Ate the First Oyster is the title.
Bravest person in the world.
It's by a writer named Cody Cassidy, and it's the extraordinary people behind the greatest firsts in history. And it's really, if you like to research, it's pretty fascinating. It's got the maps. It's got the, you know, all the information. But here are some of the, here are a couple. It's the oyster. It's who invented inventions. Who ate the first oyster. Who shot the first arrow. It's really fascinating.
Uh-huh.
So, Cody Cassidy. I haven't finished this one either, but I've gotten far enough into both of these where I've been very engrossed.
That sounds like the kind of book, both of them, that will serve you during the pandemic because it doesn't linger too long on any one thing.
Yep.
And lingering, of course, is something we're doing quite a bit of right now.
Lingering. Well, it's a good kind of lingering, I guess. Yeah. It doesn't give you too much to digest, but it gives you enough to think about.
Okay, so there are some books that you can think about, 12 Tiny Things and Who Ate the First Oyster. I think you can remember those titles. And then we talked about Kill Switch and The Man Who Ran Washington. And then, of course, we have 3 books coming out by Stephen Fry on Mythos, Heroes, and Troy. But if you can find that old book, The Marriage of Cadmus and Harmony, I guarantee you will find it a very intriguing work. The business of just telling the same story over and over sounds kind of stupid, but boy, does it work.
Yeah.
And it leads you into the fascinating world of mythology. And for most people, you'd be surprised how deeply myth runs into your life in a variety of ways. But I think it's time to summon the theme and head out of here. Thank you, Rebecca, for your reading and your time. And we thank you as well for being with us today. We'll be back with a guest in another week, and we hope you'll join us on the next edition of Scribble.